9 months into Bush's presidency, on September 11, 2001, a cataclysmic event pushed all other issues into the background. Hijackers on three different planes flew the huge jets loaded with fuel into the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center in downtown New York and into one side of the Pentagon in Washington, D.C. As Americans all over the country watched, horrified, they saw on their television screens the towers collapse in an inferno of concrete and metal, burying thousands of workers and hundreds of firemen and policemen who had gone to their rescue. It was an unprecedented assault against enormous symbols of American wealth and power, undertaken by 19 men from the Middle East, most of them from Saudi Arabia. They were willing to die in order to deliver a deadly blow against what they clearly saw as their enemy, a superpower that had thought itself invulnerable. President Bush immediately declared a war on terrorism and proclaimed, "We shall make no distinction between terrorists and countries that harbor terrorists." Congress rushed to pass resolutions giving Bush the power to proceed with military action. Without the declaration of war that the Constitution required, the resolution passed unanimously in the Senate, and in the House of Representatives, only one member dissented, Barbara Lee, an African-American from California. On the supposition that the Islamic militant Osama bin Laden was responsible for the September 11th attacks, and that he was somewhere in Afghanistan, Bush ordered the bombing of Afghanistan. Bush had declared as his objective the apprehension, quote, dead or alive, unquote, of Osama bin Laden, and the destruction of the Islamic militant organization Al-Qaeda. But after 5 months of bombing Afghanistan, when Bush delivered his State of the Union address to both houses of Congress, he had to admit, while saying, "We are winning the war on terrorism," that tens of thousands of trained terrorists are still at large, and dozens of countries were harboring terrorists. It should have been obvious to Bush and his advisors that terrorism could not be defeated by force. The historical evidence was easily available. The British had reacted to terrorist acts by the Irish Republican Army with military action again and again, only to face even more terrorism. The Israelis, for decades, had responded to Palestinian terrorism with military strikes, which only resulted in more Palestinian bombings. Bill Clinton, after the attack on U.S. embassies in Tanzania and Kenya in 1998, had bombed Afghanistan and the Sudan. Clearly, looking at September 11th, this had not stopped terrorism. Furthermore, the months of bombings had been devastating to a country that had gone through decades of civil war and destruction. The Pentagon claimed that it was only bombing military targets, that the killing of civilians was, quote, unfortunate, an accident, regrettable. However, according to human rights groups and accumulated stories in the American and West European press, at least 1,000 and perhaps 4,000 Afghan civilians were killed by American bombs. It seemed that the United States was reacting to the horrors perpetrated by terrorists against innocent people in New York by killing other innocent people in Afghanistan. Every day, the New York Times ran heart-rending vignettes of the victims of the World Trade Center tragedy, with accompanying portraits and descriptions of their work, their interests, their families. There was no way of getting similar information on the Afghan victims, but there were moving accounts by reporters writing from hospitals and villages about the effects of American bombing. A journalist with the Boston Globe, writing from a hospital in Jalalabad, wrote, "In one bed lay Nur Muhammad 10, who was a bundle of bandages. He lost his eyes and hands to the bomb that hit his house after Sunday dinner. Hospital director Guloja Shimwari shook his head at the boy's wounds, and said, "The United States must be thinking he is Osama. If he is not Osama, then why would they do this?" The report continued, "The hospital's morgue received 17 bodies last weekend, and officials here estimate at least 89 civilians were killed in several villages. In the hospital yesterday, a bomb's damage could be chronicled in the life of one family. A bomb had killed a father, Faisal Karim. In one bed, his wife, Mustafa Jama, who had severe head injuries. Around her, six of her children were in bandages. One of them, Zahidullah, 8, lay in a coma." The American public, ever since the calamity of September 11th, was overwhelmingly supportive of Bush's policy of a war on terrorism. The Democratic Party went along, vying with the Republicans on who could speak tougher language against terrorism. The New York Times, which had opposed Bush in the election, editorialized in December 2001, "Mr. Bush has proved himself a strong wartime leader who gives the nation a sense of security during a period of crisis." But the full extent of the human catastrophe caused by the bombing of Afghanistan was not being conveyed to Americans by the mainstream press and the major television networks, which seemed determined to show their patriotism. The head of the television network CNN, Walter Isaacson, sent a memo to his staff saying that images of civilian casualties should be accompanied with an explanation that this was retaliation for the harboring of terrorists. He said, "It seems perverse to focus too much on the casualties or hardships in Afghanistan." The television anchorman, Dan Rather, declared, "George Bush is the president. Wherever he wants me to line up, just tell me where." The United States government went to great lengths to control the flow of information from Afghanistan. It bombed the building housing the largest television station in the Middle East, Al Jazeera, and bought up a satellite organization that was taking photos showing the results on the ground of the bombing. Mass circulation magazines fostered an atmosphere of revenge. In Time magazine, one of its writers, under the headline, "The Case for Rage and Retribution," called for a policy of focused brutality. A popular television commentator, Bill O'Reilly, called on the United States to bomb the Afghan infrastructure to rubble, the airport, the power plants, their water facilities, and the roads. The display of the American flag in the windows of homes, on automobiles, on shop windows, became widespread. And in the atmosphere of wartime jingoism, it became difficult for citizens to criticize government policy. A retired telephone worker in California, who, working out in his health club, made a remark critical of President Bush, was visited by the FBI and questioned. A young woman found at her door two FBI men who said they had reports of posters on her wall criticizing the president. Congress passed the USA Patriot Act, which gave the Department of Justice the power to detain non-citizens simply on suspicion, without charges, without the procedural rights provided in the Constitution. It said the Secretary of State could designate any group as terrorist, and any person who was a member of or raised funds for such an organization could be arrested and held until deported. President Bush cautioned the nation not to react with hostility to Arab Americans, but in fact the government began to round up people for questioning, almost all Muslims, holding 1,000 or more in detention without charges. New York Times columnist Anthony Lewis told of one man arrested on secret evidence, and when a federal judge found there was no reason to conclude that the man was a threat to national security, the man was released. However, after September 11th, the Department of Justice, ignoring the judge's finding, imprisoned the man again, holding him in solitary confinement 23 hours a day, not allowing his family to see him.